Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Pakistan, A Very Short Introduction by Pippa Verdi. Narrated by Shakira Shute. Chapter 1. Progress of a Dream. The date, the 23rd of March 2020, marked the 80th anniversary of the Lahore Resolution, which was passed by the All India Muslim League, AIML, at its annual session in 1940. It declared that the areas in which the Muslims are numerically in a majority, as in the northwestern and eastern zones of India, should be grouped to constitute independent states. This sentence had echoes of a 1933 pamphlet by Chaudhry Ramit Ali, published in England, on behalf of 30 million Muslims of Pakistan, the five northern units of India: Punjab, Northwest Frontier, Afghan Province, Kashmir, Sindh, and Balochistan. Pak, or pure, Stan, or land, meaning land of the pure. The 1940 resolution brought full circle a vision first outlined by Sir Muhammad Iqbal in his Allahabad presidential address at the 1930 AIML session. The proposal put forward the idea that the Punjab, Northwest Frontier Province, Sindh and Balochistan should be amalgamated into a single state. Unsurprisingly, the Lahore Resolution is considered to be the bedrock of the movement that culminated in the creation of Pakistan in August 1947. Putting it to the delegates, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the League's president, in a speech made to an enraptured audience estimated at 100,000, addressed them as servants of Islam, arguing that the problem in British India was not intercommunal, but international. He offered the only solution: to allow the major nations separate homelands by dividing India into autonomous national states, asserting that Muslims were not a minority, but a nation, as out of 11 provinces of British India, they dominated in 4. He demanded that they must have their homelands, their territory, and their state. It was this that would lead, he assured, to a friendly settlement with regard to minorities, by reciprocal arrangements between Muslim India and Hindu India. This resolution and the speech came 9 months into the outbreak of the Second World War, which had momentarily paused political activity in the subcontinent. With Viceroy Linlithgow inviting Jinnah, along with Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi, leader of the Indian National Congress, seeking cooperation in the British war effort, this provided an opportunity to Jinnah to challenge Gandhi's sole authority to speak on behalf of India. He would subsequently emerge as the sole spokesman of Indian Muslims. The Qaid-e-Azam, great leader in Pakistan. As he foreshadowed in that 1940 speech, it is a dream that the Hindus and Muslims can ever evolve a common nationality. They derive their inspiration from different sources of history, different epics. To yoke together two such nations under a single state, one as a numerical minority and the other as a majority, could only mean Hindu Raj. Termed the two-nation theory, these words paved the pathway to the creation of Pakistan at the time of Indian independence in August 1947. A little later, on the 23rd of March 1949, marking the 9th anniversary of the Lahore Resolution, the progressive poet Faiz Ahmad Faiz, in his editorial for the daily The Pakistan Times, mused, "The dream is as yet unfulfilled." Faiz, for whom the bloody end of British India was not the Subh-e-Azadi, dawn of freedom, had articulated the anguish of millions in his memorable verse thus: "This light, smeared and spotted, this night-bitten dawn, this isn't surely the dawn we waited for so eagerly. This isn't surely the dawn with whose desire cradled in our hearts we had set out." Now, he lamented the fact that the ideals implicit in the Lahore Resolution were yet to be realized. Already, so much seemed to have changed including that Jinnah was no longer alive, having passed away on the 11th of September, 1948. Much of the last 70-plus years in Pakistan, and in writings on Pakistan, has been spent in what scholar Farzana Sheikh called making sense of this dream and the efforts at its realization. They range from the novelist Salman Rushdie describing the country as insufficiently imagined in 1983, to the historian Faisal Devji declaring it the Muslim Zion 30 years later. In this span of time, one of Pakistan's best-known citizens, the Lahore-born public intellectual and activist Tariq Ali, once bluntly asked, "Can Pakistan survive?" As if in an attempt to answer him, the existing literature has exhausted suggestive epigrams like "The State of Martial Rule," 1990, "Eye of the Storm," 2002, "Between Mosque and Military," 2005, "Military Inc.," 2007, "A Hard Country," 2011, "On the Brink," 2012, "A New Medina," 2014, and "The Pakistan Paradox," 2015. These titles have together typecast this Muslim homeland of over 200 million and its diaspora in contemporary global politics. The spirit of struggle for Pakistan in 1940 to 1947 has thus long since metamorphosed into the spectre of an existential crisis. While internally, the people and the regime of Pakistan confront challenges of consolidating a national culture and a political economy, externally, the nation-state has, in recent times, faced calls to be declared a rogue state. It used to be the United States of America's most allied ally in Asia during much of the Cold War, from the mid-1950s to the mid-1970s. Two events in 1979 in its Western neighbours, the Islamic Revolution in Iran and especially the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, posed a security dilemma with considerable human dimensions for Pakistan throughout the 1980s, while enhancing its intergovernmental relationship with America. Similarly, with the emergence of the Taliban in Afghanistan in 1994, and especially following the 11th of September 2001 attacks on America by Al-Qaeda, Pakistan found itself on the flight path of American power, becoming a frontline state in America's war on terror. On the 2nd of May 2011, Osama bin Laden, the founder of Al-Qaeda and thus a major target for the United States, was killed in Abbottabad, less than 100 kilometres from Pakistan's capital. His presence there, whether for a few months or for some years, as asserted by the investigative journalist Seymour Hersh in 2015, made it impossible to refute allegations of deception and duplicity concerning bin Laden's exile. Any credibility that Pakistan had in the Western international community rapidly disappeared. It is difficult to conjure up an image of Pakistan that is not associated with violent conflict, religious fundamentalism, global terrorism, the army and its agency, the inter-services intelligence, and the country's nuclear weapons. Within the region, Pakistan has been locked in conflict with India since their emergence. This increasingly unequal rivalry, which has seen four wars, extends to economic competition, diplomatic one-upmanship, and sporting battles, especially in the colonial games of cricket and field hockey. Matches between the two nations perfectly fit the Orwellian phrase of war minus the shooting. That Pakistan makes news in the Western world only when something bad happens is constantly reinforced by the clichés employed in the international media. Trying to move away from this familiar trope is challenging for writers seeking to convey the complexities of Pakistani society. However, without trying to gloss over or glorify the troubled history of a young nation, the land and its people are more than just a security risk in a seemingly forever failing state. It has a vibrant geography that is home to the Indus Valley, the site of one of the world's most ancient civilizations, the Karakoram mountain range, containing K2, the Earth's second highest peak, the Cholistan and Thar Desert, the Balochistan Plateau and the adjoining Makran arid region, and the Arabian Sea coast. Its ancient ethnic peoples, with their 70-plus languages, reflect its rich socio-cultural diversity rather than its narrow political state project. This multipolarity and complexity contribute towards why it was so difficult to realise the dream that Fares alluded to in 1949. In trying to appreciate Pakistan, this very short introduction attempts a longue durée history of the land and its peoples, and not only a 70-year snapshot of a new nation-state that emerged from the end of British India in August 1947 to become the first nation-state created on the basis of religion. At the heart of this political idea of Pakistan as a homeland for the Muslims of British India was an effort to create a distinct identity into which geographically distinct, even distant, territories could meld. It is easy to start in August 1947, when Pakistan, west and east, came into being, but without tracing its diverse and dispersed historical past, it is difficult to appreciate first why Pakistan came into being, and second, why it developed into this military bureaucratic complex that lost its eastern wing in December 1971 and is constantly balancing on a tightrope. The longer continuities between the land and its peoples are as important as the shorter changes in the political landscape. The fundamental challenge is to comprehend the political construction of Pakistan, intermingled with prior regional, ethnic, linguistic, and cultural identities. The latter provides the historical context, the former, its contemporary content. The land, the people, the politics. When the first census of Pakistan, West and East, was conducted in 1951, the combined population of both wings was 76 million, making it the sixth most populous country in the world at the time. Today, the figure for the Western wing alone is 220 million, spread over 881,913 square kilometres, approximately equal to the combined area of France and the United Kingdom. While Bangladesh, born in 1971, is at 164 million. This makes them the fifth and eighth most populous countries in the world. They are also among the largest Muslim populations, with Pakistan second only to Indonesia, while India has the third largest. In terms of gender, 51% of Pakistanis are male. Just over half the nation's population is concentrated in the province of Punjab. This is followed by Sindh, Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, KP, and Balochistan, which is the largest province but the most sparsely populated, approximately 5%. Among these, the province of KP has undergone a number of administrative changes recently. In 2010, it finally relinquished its rather indomitable and famous colonial name, Northwest Frontier Province, NWFP, and in 2018, the adjoining tribal regions bordering Afghanistan, called the Federally Administered Tribal Areas, FATA, were merged with KP. In addition to these four provinces, there are the northern areas of Gilgit-Baltistan and Azad Jammu and Kashmir, both of which are sparsely populated and politically separate, though there have been attempts to bring them administratively closer to the national capital territory of Islamabad. Indeed, in November 2020, Imran Khan declared that Gilgit-Baltistan would be given provisional status to reflect the aspirations of the indigenous people. These regions are populated by myriad ethnic and religious groups, in which both the majority and minority communities have connections to the ancient world. This is also visually evident in the streets of Pakistan, as a visitor encounters faces, admittedly usually male, that have Arabic, Persian, Afghan, Tajik, Mongolian, Indian, and Eurasian features. Racially, Pakistan represents this palimpsest of different waves of people moving into the subcontinent and there are a number of distinct groups that emerge from this. The Punjabis, descendants of the Indo-Aryans, associated with Indo-European languages, and deriving strength from their farming and agricultural background, are the single largest ethnic group. Punjab has been economically, militarily, and politically strong and cohesive, both historically and in present-day Pakistan. Being an ethnic majority, the Punjabis have dominated the political and military establishments. After 1947, the nexus between the Punjabis and refugee Muhajirs dominated, which gradually gave way to a Punjabi-Pathan nexus, crucially excluding the largely Bengali East Pakistan wing prior to 1971. Here, lineage, clan, and kinship-based networks, known as biradari, are often more powerful than simply religious or ideological affiliations. The Punjabis are followed by Sindhis and Pathans, demographically speaking, and their kaleidoscope of ethnicities and regions is complicated by additional internal layers of language and religion. While the official name of the country, adopted in 1956 and cemented by the Constitution of 1973, is the Islamic Republic of Pakistan, it is more diverse than the name suggests. In his aforementioned 1940 speech, Jinnah had been confident that the establishment of Pakistan will far more adequately and effectively safeguard the rights and interests of Muslim and various other minorities. On the verge of his achievement, on the 11th of August 1947, he reaffirmed this recognition in a much-quoted passage from a speech delivered to the Constituent Assembly of Pakistan. Even as regards Muslims, you have Pathans, Punjabis, Shias, Sunnis, and so on. And among the Hindus, you have Brahmins, Vaishnavas, Khatris, also Bengalis, and so on. You are free to go to your temples, your mosques, or to any other place or worship in this state of Pakistan. You may belong to any religion or caste or creed. That has nothing to do with the business of the state. In course of time, Hindus would cease to be Hindus, and Muslims would cease to be Muslims, not in the religious sense, because that is the personal faith of each individual, but in the political sense, as citizens of the state. These words, and the spirit behind them, continue to agitate the country and remain a source of tension. However, much more difficult to erase is the national flag of Pakistan, based as it is on the flag of the All India Muslim League. It has a vertical white strip on the left-hand side, which is an everyday reminder that the state has a commitment to protect its minorities alongside the majority community, which is represented by the dominant green. Despite this, religious persecution of minorities, approximately 7 million people, has only grown in the decade since Jinnah's death, giving rise to ghettos that both insulate and protect. Pakistan's population is 96% Muslim, with an overwhelming majority of the Sunni sect, but also including the Shias, the Ismailis, a Shia branch that emerged in the 8th century, and the disputed community of the Ahmadis. Among the rest are Christians, Hindus, and Sikhs, whose minuscule numbers complete this religious mosaic. Moreover, while officially Pakistan's national language is Urdu, it is the mother tongue of less than 10% of Pakistanis. Many millions more speak Punjabi, Pashto, Sindhi, Balochi, and Saraiki. Thus, what, from the outside, appears to be a homogeneous country is, upon closer inspection, a more complex society in which regionalism, ethnicity, faith, language, biradari, class, and gender come to the fore and recede in any given circumstance. This often volatile intersection of people produces multiple contradictions in this country, and underlying this is a strong sense of religious nationalism. Given the layered influences that comprise present-day Pakistan, it is remarkable how the state apparatus and its ideology has, over a relatively short period of time, managed to achieve this mono-religious nation-state. Underneath it, The land and the peoples of Pakistan are more than Islam, with a far more textured past and present than they are usually credited with. It is, furthermore, a young country with an average age of mid-20s. This aspiring demographic, in keeping with worldwide trends, is class-conscious and consumption-oriented. It is desirous of networks and experiences which takes its dreams beyond political boundaries. Chapter 2. The Ancient in the Modern. Attempting a long history of Pakistan, there are worse places to begin than the 5,000 Years of Pakistan, an Archaeological Outline, by R.E.M. Wheeler, published in 1950. Its preface noted that the book was intended to present the imposing material heritage of Pakistan to the outside world. An equally important purpose was to preserve this inheritance for future generations of the newborn nation. Wheeler was the Director General of the Archaeological Survey of India from 1944 to 1948, and thus found himself in the middle of that tumultuous period which saw the birth of Pakistan. He took up an advisory role in the new state, helping to organise its archaeological department and establish a national museum in its capital, Karachi. He became the first president of Pakistan Museums Associations and played a mediating role in the partition of their historical heritage between India and Pakistan. Of course, the title of his book is itself a willful paradox, for Wheeler argues for a 5,000-year history for a nation just born. Considered state propaganda, the book set out to trace a long history of Pakistan, and Wheeler followed it by writing another book, The Indus Civilization, 1953, that celebrated the major sites of one of the oldest civilizations in human history, now located inside one of its youngest nation-states. The legacy of Wheeler's mission is mixed. The sites are there, and his name is preserved in the history textbooks of Pakistan as the country's founding archaeologist. But one wonders how a modern-day Wheeler would be viewed in Pakistan, with its identity struggles. Much later, another book, The Indus Saga and the Making of Pakistan, 1996, followed, taking forward the archaeological vestiges laid out by Wheeler. Its author, Azaz Asan, politician and lawyer, attempted to uncover the true bedrock of Pakistan's national identity, buried under the glaciers of myth. By dividing the history of this legendary age of Indus from the everyday realities of a shared memory between India and Pakistan. Asan claimed that the Indus had remained independent of and separate from India for 5,000 years. He alludes to two distinct regions: the Indic region of India's Gangetic Plains and the Indus region of Pakistan. In doing so, Asan continued the reaffirmation of the idea of two nations. However, ancient topographical boundaries, migrating people, and shifting and changing languages rarely observed the constraints of modern hard political borders. This chapter follows Wheeler's outline, from the Indus to the arrival of the first Arabs, albeit in a fragmented way, for the regions that make up modern Pakistan. The aim is to give but a glimpse of their diverse historical continuum that increasingly goes under-remarked and unremembered. The material and cultural connections and confluences of these, through the ages, belie the image of a modern monolith, whose history is as multi-layered as its neighbours, just as India's populist politics now share a strong smear of narrow nationalism. The Indus Valley Civilization. There is little disagreement that one of the earliest civilizations the world has known flourished in and around the basin of the Indus River and its tributaries in the present-day Pakistani provinces of Sindh, Punjab, and Balochistan. From around circa 3200 BCE to circa 1300 BCE, there thrived in phases a civilization later named after the river, whose first and famous discoveries were made at Harappa in Punjab and Mohenjo-daro, the Mound of the Dead Men, in Sindh. Harappa, The identifier site by which the civilization is also known is located near the Ravi River, one of the Punjab tributaries of Indus. Archaeological excavations began at these sites in 1920 to 1921 and slowly lifted the lid from a heritage that has eventually amounted to over 1,000 sites, with 400-plus in Pakistan, spread over almost 800,000 square kilometres, and including all the four provinces of Punjab, Sindh, Balochistan, and KP. These discoveries established that the start of settled civilization and urban culture on the subcontinent was contemporaneous with those in Mesopotamia, Iraq, Egypt, and China. In fact, from Meher, Balochistan, there is evidence of farming communities dating back to the 7th millennium BCE, hinting at a prehistory of Harappan sites. Of these excavated sites, it is Mohenjo-daro in Sindh, with its distinctive citadel mound comprising the Great Bath, Granary, and College of Priests, as well as a bronze female figurine famous as the Dancing Girl, which has become emblematic of this civilization. Similar to Mohenjo-daro, Harappa's citadel, cemetery, and granary have become iconic. This long and diverse culture, distinguished by its typical red and black pottery, terracotta cones and cakes, standardized bricks and copper artifacts, is found in a network of early proto-urban villages, mature and fully-fledged urban cities, and late declining towns. The level of architectural planning found in these two sites was unparalleled in the ancient world. The full breadth and depth of that civilization is a phenomenon still being explored. The Indus Valley civilization is said to have begun to decline around 1900 BCE, and in 1953, Wheeler suggested that the invasion of an Indo-European tribe, the Aryans, had been the reason. However, this theory has since been challenged, and alongside this, it is argued that natural disasters like floods, rising coastline, desiccation, and man-made disasters, like over-exploitation of environment, led to a definite, if gradual, de-urbanization. Thus, as their archaeological traces thinned, their place in this historical canvas was taken over by the oral narratives of the Aryans and their texts. The Aryans, who arrived in the upper reaches of the Indus region around 1500 BCE, brought with them their sacrificial religion and language, Sanskrit. The Rig Veda, the oldest among their oral narratives, was composed sometime between 1500 and 1000 BCE, consisting of a variety of hymns which had been compiled by about 1000 BCE. It and related texts, known collectively as the Vedas, were put together around present-day southeastern Afghanistan and Pakistani Punjab, the region of Sapta Sindhu, seven sacred rivers mentioned in the Rig Veda. The later Aryan texts were composed further east in the Indo-Gangetic Divide and the upper Ganges Valley, thus providing an unwitting basis for Assan's two-region theory. The cultural corpus of the Aryans formed a precursor to the Vedic ideas and practices that would metamorphose into the Brahmanical socio-cultural order, feeding into present-day Hinduism. Contrary to the 19th and 20th century invocations of an Aryan race, these Indo-Aryans emerged from the speakers of a subgroup of the Indo-Iranian branch of the Indo-European family of languages. Remnants of these people and language still exist in Pakistan. Indeed, many of the rural technologies, architectural designs, and social ordering that exist today can be traced back, albeit via dotted lines, and notwithstanding state amnesias, to these earlier civilizations of the Indus Valley. Gandhara, Ashoka, and Buddhism. The period between circa 1710 and 200 BCE saw the flourishing of the so-called Gandhara grave culture. The Galagay Cave, a rock shelter excavated in the 1950s to 1960s, was found to contain engravings, paintings, inscriptions and carvings, rock art. Located in the Swat Valley, along the rivers of Swat and Dir, It is thought to be associated with the hunter-gatherer Indo-Aryans before they settled down.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?